Joseph. I'm a fellow at Georgetown University, and I'm also a contributing editor and blogger for Foreign Policy. And this is today I have.
And this is Andres Martinez. I direct the Fellows Program here at the New America Foundation.
Good. Good to talk to you, Andres. So what do we want to talk about today?
Well, we have a lot to talk about in terms of events in Russia and the reset. So Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, has been in Moscow this week. I think she was expecting to cash in on the Obama administration's change of policy on the missile defense system, and I don't think she's quite gotten the windfall that she was expecting, but the reset is proceeding. And one of the things I thought would be interesting to start off with you, given that it's one of your a subject close to your hand, close to your heart, I should say, is the way in which the administration is interacting not just with the Russian leadership, and we can get to that, but with Russian civil society groups and NGOs and activists. And there's been quite a lot of talk about whether the Obama administration is promoting this kind of outreach and democracy, or is it de-emphasizing, you know, the human rights democracy agenda after it was somewhat tainted under the Bush years. And it seems to me it's always going to be kind of a very dicey proposition how you go about this in Russia. So how do you assess what Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration has been doing in terms of going over to Moscow and not just meeting with whoever, you know, choose your leader, Putin or Medvedev, but these civil society groups?
Sure. Well, I think it actually continues the policy established under Bush. I mean, when Bush went to Moscow, he usually met with a very broad array of, you know, intellectuals and civil society leaders and NGOs and activists. So from that perspective, it's not really a reset, right? If it's a reset, it's a very dubious one, right? But I think there have been a lot of fears in Moscow that this new push by Obama to try to engage with Moscow and try to have Moscow behind that when negotiating with Iran will actually undermine some of the support and some of the efforts that the previous administration have done reaching out to the activists, but also in terms of criticizing the human rights situation in Russia and the lack of freedom of speech and the immense pressure on Russian journalists. I think so far the results are quite mixed. It's true that both Obama and Clinton actually have made sure that they do meet with civil society and they do meet with people whom Kremlin would not necessarily put on the agenda for the meetings, and they have met with them. The problem is that it's still not clear whether civil society will have any input into policymaking on both ends. I mean, so what, after the Obama visit, one of the most tangible accomplishments, of his trip was this new commission to be headed by Michael McFaul on the American side and by Vladislav Surkov on the Russian side, right? And that will be a governmental, mostly, commission, which will look into, you know, the civil society issues and NGO issues. And the problem with that commission is that it's not at all clear and guaranteed that civil society will be represented. And there is a good chance that it will be just, state-appointed bureaucrats. And there are some critical state-appointed human rights bureaucrats in Russia. But there is still this fear that even this new commission will only be another way to kind of streamline and regulate Kremlin's management of civil society and civil society issues. So
it was interesting. You mentioned McFaul. I mean, he was on the trip with the Secretary of State and apparently was quoted in one of the Moscow dailies saying that the Obama administration is not going to be banging the table on democracy and human rights, that that's not the president's style to wag his finger. And then he apparently said he was misquoted. But one of the things that I always find interesting is the tension between, on the one hand, they've created this intergovernmental commission, as you point out, which seems like a great way to kind of make the thing be completely divorced from any real civil society. But also, you have the genuine, legitimate activists on the Russian side lobbying the Americans to not de-emphasize the subject, to keep, pressing their Russian counterparts. And I can understand their frustration. I mean, Russia is like the third most dangerous country in the world to be a journalist these days.
Mm-hmm.
You have all these unresolved killings of anybody who's, I mean, lots of great journalists like Anna Politkovskaya, who's written critically of the situation, and these murders never get resolved. So I can understand that if I'm in that milieu, I'd want to be lobbying foreign governments to lobby my government to resolve these issues and to be more respectful of my freedom. On the other hand, I just wonder if it doesn't taint these activists and these civil society groups and a sort of to a broader audience. That doesn't it play into the hands of the government to say, well, these are kind of foreign agents? I mean, Putin has been very adept at this.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this in country after country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have dissidents in Cuba that we really want to reach out to, but how do you resolve the paradox that once you reach out to them, you've kind of tainted them in a way? I mean,
mm-hmm.
you might help them individually, you know, particularly if they or collaborators have been jailed to not let the foreign regime get away
sure.
with doing this in the darkness,
mm-hmm.
but aren't you kind of minimizing then their effectiveness to...
Mm-hmm.
What's your take
yeah.
on that?
Well, look, I think there are very few activists, visible activists in Russia, who have not yet been tainted, right, from that perspective. You know,
mm-hmm.
they just run out of people who haven't yet been tainted by some kind of cooperation with the U.S. government structures or European Union structures or the foundations, right? So I think it's already by 2009, after almost two decades of, struggle for freedom and democracy in Russia, I think it's just a bit too late to kind of start thinking of how do you try to come up with civil society that actually is genuine and is not supported by the government. And it's not supported by the foreign government of any kind, right? What I think the very dubious message from Kremlin so far has been is that the person appointed to head this panel from the Russian side, Vladislav Surkov, he is actually the one who is most responsible for eliminating any kind of civil society in
right.
Russia,
right.
right? And that has been the major criticism of most Russian NGOs and activists. They, I think, very legitimately say that if Kremlin is serious about taking on this issue, why didn't Medvedev appoint someone with better credentials? I mean, Surkov
right.
is basically the person who, set up Nashi, this youth movement group, which is not exactly a civil society organization, and which
right.
developed the ideology of the current regime. Right. So
didn't he coin that term of sovereign
democracy?
Which
that's
is kind
right.
Of,
that's exactly
we're
right.
We're going to do it our
so,
way.
So, I think they do have a point that if Kremlin is genuine in its efforts to try to liberalize, the situation in Russia and open up to civil society initiatives, they have to choose someone who is not as, tainted themselves.
Right.
So it's almost like, if Obama had to appoint someone to investigate the Bush administration, and he would have come up with Karl Rove. It's more or less the same analogy.
Right. On this, but this commission is not. It's only going to look into civil society in Russia, right? It's not like a. Is it a two-way street? I mean, can
well,
the Russians?
Well, it's very interesting because that's what the Russians are pushing for.
Seems to me.
Occasions, both Putin and Medvedev have actually said that, why are we only looking into the question of freedoms and human rights in Russia? Why not
right.
look at America itself? Right. So they have actually set up a number of think tanks and NGOs in Washington and America, which will actually pretend at least to be looking at, levels of freedoms and human rights and democracy in the U.S. So I think
right.
from the Russian side, there is generally this effort to push to examine what's happening in America, whether it's, in American prisons, elsewhere. So it is going to be a two-way street because that's what Kremlin wants.
Let me just make perfectly clear that the New America Foundation is not one of these think tanks created by Moscow to look into the situation in the United States. But on this question of how do you go about your work as a human rights activist or an independent journalist in these tough authoritarian societies and seek assistance and support and linkage and solidarity with foreign groups while not kind of there. Undermining your legitimacy, do you think there's a difference between if the advocacy is coming from the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as opposed to the Committee to Protect Journalists or Human Rights Watch as opposed to the EU, or is it sort of all of the same. I mean, if you were advising Hillary Clinton on how to exert pressure and be supportive of these people, does it make sense for the United States to kind of take the lead, or should we kind of defer to groups like the Carnegie and Human Rights Watch, or does it not make a difference at the end of the day? Because
I think it's a very difficult question. I mean, if you judge by the previous administration, right, often having dissidents and activists from the Middle East, you know, meet with George Bush meant that, you know, on coming back home, they'll immediately be interrogated and arrested. Right? That was actually almost a straight ticket to prison, right? Right. So I'm not so sure it's going to be the case with this administration, simply because it's just a little bit more popular, and it's more popular in Russia, you know, than elsewhere. But I do think there is still a large role to play for the NGO and to, you know, then foreign foundations. The problem is that they are also mostly tainted already in Russia, right? And right. You know, and even neutral one. I mean, even the British Council, right, which does purport to work only in the sphere of culture and education, for example. I mean, the British Council has emerged as, you know, the political enemy. So how right. to involve more openly political entities like Human Rights Watch into this would be very difficult, because, you know, all of them have already a very bad reputation in the Russian state-owned media, right? And there are more and more, I think what we also have to realize about Russia is that the Kremlin has been engaged in the strategy to create their own controlled civil society. There is this very interesting new word which appeared in Russian called GONG, which is, stands for, you know, government-controlled NGO, right? Which sounds like an oxymoron, but there are more and more of them, right? Which tend to act like an NGO, but you know that they are funded and controlled by right. some kind of state structure. And they are more or less crowding out the genuine NGOs, right? And whether they will essentially be able to succeed in building this new state-controlled civil society in Russia, you know, it's hard to say, but they are definitely growing.
Right, right. So what's your take on the state of the reset more broadly? I mean, in terms of the bilateral relationship and...
Well, I think, you know, Russians are definitely very practical, and they are definitely very pragmatic when it comes to, you know, negotiating. So you do hear Medvedev make very broad statements that, you know, sometimes sanctions are inevitable, you know, which is, you know, generally true, right? They are sometimes inevitable. Right? But then you hear, you know, the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov or Putin basically say that, no, it's still premature to impose sanctions on Iran. You know, Putin in Beijing just made the statement saying that, you know, we do think it's premature. Right? So I'm not sure that the gains are for the Obama administration of, you know, changing their mind about the missile system actually are justified. I'm not yet sure that they are going to get anything from Kremlin. And the fact that Putin was actually in Beijing, was in China, meeting with not only the Chinese leadership, but also the leadership of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where they did have observers from Iran. I think it is a very symbolic statement, which tends to say, you know, to the U.S. that, look, you know, we are talking, but, you know, we still have our own interests.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit sympathetic to the Russian position that there shouldn't have been an overt quid pro quo, that from their point of view, it was always overly aggressive and illegitimate from their perspective that, you know, the NATO was installing radars in the Czech Republic and a missile defense system in Poland, ostensibly to protect from, you know, long-range missiles from Iran. I mean, if your point of view is that this is kind of a stab in the back and it's more sort of strangulation of Russia, and this new administration comes in and does, quote, the right thing from their point of view, I'm not sure that you need to the next day turn around and give the U.S. everything they want in Iran. I mean, I think it's a little, all these, the criticism that we don't have enough to show for this yet, I think is a bit churlish. It hasn't been a month. And, you know, but that just, you know, I tend to take a longer historical view and feel that, you know, we're kind of reaping the benefits of what we sowed, and or the opposite of the benefits in terms of treating the Russia the way we did in the 90s, and not seeing their kind of how NATO expansion was going to be perceived mm-hmm. in their eyes. So, you know, I think time will tell. And they have been more cooperative on Afghanistan.
Sure. But you know, we should also probably mention the statement which Alexander Vershbo, you know, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, made a few, you know, I think almost a week ago, where he did hint that Ukraine actually asked to be considered
this
as
was
a potential host for...
You thought you won this argument,
system.
But... right.
And that generated just so much, you know, hysteric voices in Russia where everyone assumed already that,
right.
you know, the U.S. has moved on. You know, and the fact that it was Vershbo who basically made that statement, you know, he's a very public figure in Russia because he used to be the U.S. ambassador to Russia for 5 years, 4 years, I think. So it's definitely, I think, if even Washington, I think, is extremely pragmatic here. So, I mean, I do think that statement from Vershbo was actually calculated, and, you know, it also the timing was... I think extremely suspicious that
was it almost sounded like it sounded like a rogue hawk within the administration speaking out of turn, and it was interesting. Secretary of State Clinton's address, I think it was this morning mm-hmm. at Moscow State, and there's great pictures of it for those of you who haven't seen it. Of, I mean, this huge, you know, Soviet mural behind her,
mm-hmm.
Which looks like it's like 5 stories tall, and the hammer mm-hmm. and sickle and the workers and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and she's basically saying, you know, I've decided to no longer think of myself as a child of the Cold
yes,
War.
Yes.
It was a town hall meeting. But there was this very kind of odd formulation in her speech where she talks about there are some people in my government and some people in your government who don't want us to get along. It almost sounds like there were moles still and the people who want to keep going with the Cold War. And, you know, and then I was thinking back to the comment you just referred about, well, maybe Ukraine. It was very oblique, so who knows? But mm-hmm. I wonder if she feels that there are still people within even the U.S. government who are trying to sabotage any kind of improvement in relations, or feel that you know
mm-hmm.
these guys are being too
mm-hmm.
soft or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other alternative is that was actually calculated more towards Ukraine than towards Russia.
Right.
But there are elections coming up in Ukraine, and it is important to sort of for the U.S. to show support now that the, you know, NATO membership for Ukraine is not at all certain. So,
right.
It may just be, you know, the Russian reaction may just have been, you know, byproduct while it was actually targeted at Kiev.
Right. And what do you make of the good cop, bad cop routine that Medvedev and Putin have been playing
mm-hmm.
for quite some time now? And do you think there's any sort of real daylight between the two in terms of positions, or is this kind of a very mm-hmm. clever PR, you know, so that Medvedev one day gives us reassuring but vague signals about what they might do in with Iran, and Putin can say, not really. Is there Medvedev has had a lot of very benign rhetoric about and self-criticism about how Russia needs to be more democratic
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
and the rule of law needs to be strengthened. And but then there doesn't seem to be much there. But
mm-hmm.
it's hard to tell that whether there's not much there simply because he doesn't have the power to
mm-hmm.
to do mm-hmm. the reforms, or whether it's just meaningless, you know,
mm-hmm.
pretty talk to cover up for the power, as they say
mm-hmm.
in Moscow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the system they have now is actually perfect for, you know, diffusing responsibility. Because
right.
you never know who actually is responsible, right? You don't know who to blame. You don't even know what policy is being made in Russia these days, right? Whether it's Medvedev or Putin, or whether it's Surkov, or whether it's some other shady, you know, shadow, you know, strategist who we don't actually know. So I don't think Medvedev has more power than Putin as Russia is, you know, is set up now. I don't think he will anytime soon. It all depends on what we see in the next elections. And I do think we wouldn't know what we see in the next elections until probably, you know, a few months before they need to take place. Because once
right.
either of them announces who is the real leader, I mean, the other one will just be a lame duck. right? So I think we will be living in this very uncertain age where we have no idea which of them is actually behind policymaking. But I think, you know, it's still mostly Putin who calls most of the shots, you know, and he particularly, you know, active on a lot of foreign policy issues, I think. But also, right. you have to keep in mind that Russia is just hit by this terrible financial crisis, which is much more terrible in Russia than it is in the U.S.
Right.
So Putin is spending a lot of his political capital on traveling around Russia and, you know, making sure that, you know, the auto industry doesn't die as quickly as it can. You know, so I think it's actually very wise, because if Medvedev started doing that, you know, he would probably run out of gas and run out of support pretty quickly. But Putin is actually, you know, he's such a prominent figure in Russia that, you know, he's actually very effective at sort of, you know, managing this public outrage, which, you know, could have been much more vocal, and it's not, you know, and then the right. financial situation is so dire, and people are still not, you know, rallying behind the opposition, nor, you know, asking for the government to be overthrown, which I think is a big achievement for Putin.
That's true. I mean, that's sort of a global theme. I mean, I'm impressed by the sort of political resilience in so many countries where you would have expected to have more more instability as a result of this financial crisis, and actually more blatant anti-Americanism too. Maybe less so in Russia, but you know, this is a financial crisis that in many ways was kind of exported from the U.S., which is a real contrast from the old financial contagions, which, you know, started in the developing emerging markets, and the U.S. used to be the fireman. Well, now we're the arsonist who started this. And I suspect there must be all sorts of conspiracy theories in Moscow about why we did this to sort of.
But I think Russia is also quietly taking advantage of the crisis on the foreign policy front. I mean, I don't know if you saw that they recently promised something like $1 billion to Serbia. Right, and then Putin will actually be going to the Balkans, Medvedev, I think, will be going to the Balkans on the day of Serbia's liberation by Russia in, I think, 19th century. So they are taking advantage of many of the opportunities in the near broader place, because, you know, the immediate entity that was supposed to be funding all of this is the European Union, and they don't seem to have much money either. So it's very interesting how, you know, Kremlin, despite the fact that they have very little money left themselves, are actually eager to put money on the table to bring some of the smaller states into their foreign policy orbit.
Well, related to that, I was reading interesting reports from the Commonwealth on Independent States Summit the other day. It was kind of news to me that they were still having these summits, and but all of these credits that Russia is offering, you know, the Moldovas and the others, they were having a bit of a tiff about whether the credit should be in dollars, and the Russians saying, no, let's keep it in our currencies, which I thought was a very savvy way of. But I love, too, that the big resolution of the summit was everybody agreed that next year they're going to come together to commemorate the 65th anniversary of the victory in the Great Patriotic War. So, you know, no matter what, you can always count on the Russians to be able to sort of try to rally people around the past. And but some of the countries were chafing at the old Soviet terminology, the Great Patriotic War, and they wanted to sort of have the commemoration for the victory in World War II. And because obviously it's for them it was more of a mixed bag, but the Russians still were able to ram that through.
It's a huge internal issue in Russia now, and I think, you know, that issue has been put on the back burner since the early 90s, and nobody wanted to talk about it. But now there are more and more discussions with regards to the legacy of the war, right, and whether it was good or not. There was a huge scandal, public scandal in Russia a few weeks ago, when one of the restaurants in Moscow decided to call itself anti-Soviet. So that was actually what their name sat, you know, outside on
Oh, really?
And one of the Russian very populist bureaucrats actually said that you can't call yourself anti-Soviet because, you know, Soviet times were, you know, it's great legacy for us, right? So it's kind of an offense to people who fought in the Great War. and so forth and so forth. And then one of the Russian dissidents actually wrote an essay saying that, you know, Soviet times were actually terrible and we should be having a discussion about it. Right. And then Nashi, this youth group, started attacking him publicly and started going after him, and that actually prompted one of the, you know, NGOs and civil society leaders in Russia to rally behind him, because this poor man was basically chased by this quasi civil society entity that Nashi is in modern Russia. Right. So, and I think that opened this Pandora's box in Russia's recent history, which Russians haven't fully addressed.
Yeah.
And, you know, next year they may be addressing it, you know, in full.
Right, right. That's interesting. So I was reading on your blog, which is called Net Effect, and it's on foreign policy, and it's a great read. So I've done my plug here. But I was reading about, speaking of what Russia is doing beyond its borders, and not just in the near abroad, but tell us about their telecom diplomacy in Central America, because this was fascinating.
Yes, what I think is overlooked is that Russia is very active with its business muscles, not only in terms of energy and oil and gas, but more increasingly in terms of telecoms as well. So what I discovered is that, you know, one of the Russian companies, which is partly owned by the Russian government, actually recently won a tender in Nicaragua to, you know, supply it with, I think, 3G network, but also to supply it with landline telephony as well. You know, and they managed to underbid many other bigger and more established players, right? And it's very interesting because, you know, as you might know, that was the only country which recognized the independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia last year,
right?
And nobody could actually make sense of what, why, you know, it's so far.
Well, you know, that part of the world has been, I mean, I think all the remaining countries that still recognize Taiwan or in the Caribbean, you know, and they got something for it. So it's kind of
And, you know, and then 1 month after they recognized, you know, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, their president of Nicaragua actually went to Moscow in a series of meetings, and nobody knew what was discussed. But it could as well be that, you know, Russian companies were, you know, state-owned Russian companies were actually ordered to go and be that, you know, at lower prices or kind of bestow some kind of other business benefits. And now what's interesting is that the same company is trying to get into Venezuela, right? And Hugo Chavez last month, I think, actually also stated that, you know, he is going to recognize Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So it's also very interesting how, you know,
Evgeny, have you recognized South Ossetia?
Has he? I don't know if he has, but...
No, I'm asking, have you?
Oh, have...
Because this is your chance on Blogging Heads.
You I haven't yet. No, I'm still.
But they have a flag and they have all the attributes. Well, what's interesting
it's
about
a funny question because I come from Belarus originally, and even Belarus, which is Russia's closest ally, you know, in foreign policy, technically we have a union state. Even they haven't, you know. But again,
really,
yes, you know, and I think that hasn't happened because. You know, the president of Belarus more or less wants to get something out of it as well.
Right.
So he's trying to raise his bar, and I'm sure he will eventually. But it's just interesting how for Russia, even having those two republics recognized, carries a certain cost, which I think now everyone wants to get out of Russia.
right. But what's interesting about all this is, you're right. I mean, we're all familiar with Russia, you know, throwing its weight around in terms of, you know, its energy policy and, you know, the pipelines and natural gas supply to neighboring countries in Western Europe and so forth. And, I mean, I didn't realize that they had the wherewithal to do this. I mean, perhaps with arms, you know, sales and stuff, but there it's as much in their benefit
but, you know, what,
to customers. But telecom? I mean, really?
Yeah. Well, what's even more interesting is that that company, which now has expanded to Nicaragua and Venezuela, only has coverage in two or three major Russian cities. And so they don't even cover, you know, one-tenth of the Russian territory, right? And they're already going, you know, international, which I find
fascinating. But on your plan, you can have friends and family in Nicaragua and Venezuela. And
I guess so, yes. And so now, you know, Russians will have a chance to talk to...
maybe we can
to dial into Hugo Chavez's radio show, I guess, which is TV
right,
show.
Right. Yes. Well, one of the biggest providers of cell phone service in Venezuela is Carlos Slim's company.
Yes.
America Móvil, which is everywhere in Latin America. And so I wouldn't be surprised if Chavez is trying to take market share away from people like these foreign transnationals like Slim's, and maybe the Russians can fill that niche a little bit, although it is kind of surprising if they could. What's the name of this company, of the Russian?
I think it's called, well, it has several names. I think it's called StarTel, which, Scartel, actually.
Scartel?
Which also is a funny title, because it's supposed to scare, I guess. It's actually spelled as S-C-A-R-Tel, right? But they also have a separate brand, which is called Yota, which is Y-O-T-A. So, but what I wanted to ask you, do you have any sense of what's happening now with Cuba and sort of its position on communications and the internet? Because I have seen very mixed signals coming out of the country, because in one sense, they have allowed citizens to access the internet from post offices now.
Right.
But they have also imposed a ban on all voice over internet protocol technology, which means basically Skype, right? So you can't use Skype to call abroad, for example. But at the same time, you see the Venezuelan companies coming in to lay the fiber cable to Cuba. Now there is an American company who should be doing the same. Do you get any sense that Cuba is embracing the internet, or is just all for economic development purposes? What do you make of it?
Well, I think this is the tough balancing act that a lot of countries have to undertake, right? They need to upgrade their networks and telecommunications for development purposes, but they're very wary of what comes with that. Although you have written persuasively that governments can actually pull this off a lot of times, and that. The ever evolving technologies don't always work to empower individuals vis-a-vis the state. That sometimes works the other way around. I'm not an expert on what's actually happening inside Cuba. I did. We had an event here with Ann Louise Bardach, who just wrote an interesting book on Cuba post Fidel. Cuba while Fidel dies, which seems to be a generation-long process. And she made the interesting point that you have pretty outspoken bloggers that one can read in Cuba, and this is great for foreign correspondents and reporters and analysts who can't get visas to go to Cuba, but they can read bloggers inside. But it's one of these kind of dissonant things where not that many people in Cuba, as you point out, can read these bloggers, so the regime maybe is not so worried about it. Mm-hmm. Although there's a young woman, one of these bloggers, Giovanni
Sanchez.
Sanchez. She just won a journalism award from Colombia, and the government denied her visa to come get her award, which is stupid. It's self-defeating for the government. It's so churlish. It only gives her more attention, I think.
But so
you have this phenomenon of bloggers who are being feted beyond the island for writing courageous stuff, and maybe the government shrugs it off because if nobody can get online. But I think this is kind of an ongoing cat and mouse game. It is interesting that a U.S.-based company is getting a license to lay fiber optic to Cuba, and there's all these rumblings.
But they're getting the license from the U.S. Treasury, but they're not getting a license from Cuba.
No, that's what I mean. It's interesting. I mean, Cuba clearly wants to develop its infrastructure. I'm heartened that even though we still have outdated policies vis-a-vis Cuba, that we're at least mindful that this is in everyone's interest. And so that the Treasury is giving these licenses so that it's not just Venezuelan companies developing the stuff within Cuba. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And Russia, the Russian sort of involvement in Latin America, of late kind of plays into the sort of triangulating. And, you know, Chavez has been very adept. Well, Chavez is actually buying a lot of Russian equipment, which is which is good for the Russian arms industry.
Yes.
But people here in Washington, they get so, you know, excited when Freudian slip, you know, a Russian naval ship pays a visit to Caracas. And, you know, come on, it's like, really. But I was talking to somebody the other day who was making the point, actually your editor at Foreign Policy, Susan Glasser, was saying, you know, Russia just doesn't have that many friends, like real friends. I mean, if you think of the world as a playground and countries as kids, like Russia is kind of sulking in the corner alone. And I said, well, what about Belarus? and she was saying, well, even there, apparently, there's starting to be some tensions. And I kind of got sad thinking about, you know, poor Russia with no friends. And I said, well, Chavez, and they're like, she was like, well, they're not really friends. And so why do you think Russia has no friends?
How? Well, I mean, historical reasons, I think, play a role, particularly in Eastern Europe, you know, Central Asia, and, you know, you still have a lot of people in Central Eastern Europe feeling animosity for the Soviet past. And you say, I don't think those feelings are going to going to go away anytime soon, even though, you know, I go to the Baltic states quite often, and, you know, what I see in the Baltic states is that more and more young people actually are angry with their parents because their parents put them only in, you know, Lithuanian or Latvian or Estonian only schools, right? So essentially they didn't get a chance to study Russian, and now they are less competitive in the workplace. Right. So many of them are actually reconsidering this radical denunciation of all things Russian.
Really?
And actually
that's interesting.
They are enthusiastic about learning the language because, you know, Russia is still a huge economic power.
Right.
So I think some of that will change, but I don't think, you know, the desire to study Russian will somehow make them more susceptible to Kremlin's own foreign agenda. Right, so I think it will be very practical engagement, just like many people are now studying Chinese, right, or, you know, Mandarin. It doesn't really translate into great admiration of China. It's more taking advantage of economic opportunities. But, you know, and I think Russia hasn't done much to cultivate friends. I mean, like, if you really think about it, their only friends right now are probably Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And maybe, you know, Transnistria, this very obscure regime between, you know, Moldova and Ukraine. But Russia hasn't done much to cultivate them. So I'm not even sure that Palestine might be another one. But that's it.
Yeah, I mean I was thinking maybe Vietnam a little bit because Vietnam had the you know, for Vietnam the neighborhood bully was always China and there's some kind of
But look, I think the bigger point here is that Russia still hasn't come up with a coherent ideology to succeed you know, the Soviet one, whether domestically or internationally. I mean, there is no idea of what Russia stands for. Right, internationally. And then what you have mentioned about the CIS summit in Chisinau in Moldova, you know, that Russia is still talking about the Soviet past and the Great War, it just shows that they still haven't got over those old ideals and those old problems. That there is no more in Russia that they can go and market and sell to young Lithuanians or Poles or Czechs or, you know, Venezuelans for that matter. So essentially it's a bankrupt regime ideologically. And then you see it less on the domestic level because, you know, you do have people like Surkov and Pavlovsky who are very good at coming up with fancy but essentially meaningless terms like sovereign democracy. You just see it much more vividly on the international level where there is no idea of Russia for people to buy into.
Well, and actually the two are sort of related. I feel that Russia, and this goes back, you know, prior to the Soviet era, this sense that, you know, we are surrounded and that there are all these other powers that are trying to thwart our legitimate claim to be a significant power, that actually creates a rationale for authoritarian power within, right? I mean, and sort of the you know, our Russia and the Nazi and all the ideology of the Putin regime partly it's, you know, we need to be united, literally, and have a common front because our country's encircled. And so this idea that we don't have that many friends overseas because there are all these, you know, people thwarting our legitimate claims means that we need to come together and show solidarity. So it's kind of interesting how that is something that is exploited. I mean, the sort of lack of imagination to create some kind of ideology that you can project overseas.
I mean, the only ideology which I think they have come up with internationally, and I shouldn't say come up with, they rediscovered that, is this philosophy of Eurasianism, you know, where there were several very influential philosophers in Russia early in the century, in the 20th century, who argued that, you know, essentially Russia has to bridge this, you know, gap between European and Asian values, and we have to make sure that we kind of balance them, and we're not very European and we're not very Asian. So, you know, but essentially, you look at this, and, you know, and there are many proponents of this ideology in Russia, and, you know, and Putin has mentioned it often, this, you know, Eurasianism. But you look at it, I mean, basically means, in practice, that Russia wants to be more Asian than, say, China. I mean, China wants to be much more Western-minded than Russia under this, you know, philosophy of Eurasianism. And essentially, I'm not sure many people buy into it. But on the subject of Eurasianism, it's very interesting, coming back to Clinton's visit, it's very interesting that Clinton chose to go to Kazan, you know, the capital of Tatarstan, completely out of the blue, I would say. Right? It's, what do you make of it?
Well, I couldn't figure out if this was in the planning stages of a visit like this. Was this her call, or is this like the Russians suggest, you know, go to, it did seem... completely out of the blue and not the, the expected stop. And it seemed to play into the Russian narrative of being able to point to a place that is very diverse, the majority Islamic population, where you don't have the strife and you don't have, I mean, at least that's my understanding. So it seemed to be kind of a win-win for both Clinton and the Russians. But am I wrong?
Well, I think, it's still very hard for me to interpret what exactly they wanted to accomplish with it. Right. You know, as far as I understand, they did have several other cities on it, as, you know, which were floated as potential options. You will see, you know, Nizhny Novgorod or Samara, which are, you know, probably more obvious choices because they are closer to Moscow and they are more or less closer to this description of being a cradle of the Russian civilization or whatever. So, I mean, Kazan was actually a very interesting choice because it's also, it's much more turbulent than it is presented in the news. I mean, there is a very interesting opposition in Tatarstan, which is, you know, it's the republic of which Kazan is the capital of, where you do have a lot of locals who have their own language, who have, you know, who are Muslim and who are not particularly excited by this new drive coming out of Moscow to establish Russian as the major teaching language in school, language of instruction, to establish Christianity as the dominant religion in Russia and in Tatarstan. And, you know, it's actually a very interesting case because, you know, not that it's very likely, but, you know, it can be the next Chechnya, right? Because you do have people who do have a very strong sense of ethnic identity. And, you know, they don't seem to be very happy with this new move to homogenize Russia coming out of Kremlin. So, you know, and Clinton would choose to go
there. They haven't bought into the Eurasian...
They are much closer to this philosophy of Eurasianism than other parts of Russia. So the fact that Clinton chose to go there, you know, you can as well read it as... American signaling to the Russian opposition or to Tatar opposition that, you know, we know what's going on, and should anything happen, you can count on us. But, you know, that would be very smart.
Well, it would be interesting to see. I mean, I'm not... She had some pointed things to say at Moscow State. It'd be interesting to go and look and see what, you know, whether... That's her tone. What her tone was when she was in Kazan, in terms of speaking to groups who might be resent what's happening in terms of the education reforms coming out of Moscow and the kind of linguistic jingoism and such.
Yeah. But it's also interesting that she was actually getting, geographically speaking, was getting closer to where Putin was. Right, so it's interesting that she actually gravitated towards Asia, where there was this big meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Right, right.
So it's actually very symbolic. I mean, she could have gone to Kaliningrad, you know, and be in the most western part of Russia if she wanted.
Right.
But she actually, I think, chose a very interesting point to land. So.
I just wanted to throw something out there also for historical perspective, because we can get so wrapped up in Washington and, you know, in sort of academic think tanky government circles about, you know, these resets and what are the terms that we're going to use, and we put so much thought into this stuff. And I was a very kind of interesting cautionary tale. Anecdotally, Nick Thompson, who's one of our fellows here at New America, recently came out with a very engaging book called The Hawk and the Dove, and it's kind of the dual biography about looking at the rivalry and friendship between George Kennan and Paul Nitze, you know, two of the sort of long-serving architects of our Cold War policy. And but he had a great point, a very interesting point, where he talks about, you know, there was a certain moment where people in our world here in Washington in a past generation were, you know, really battling out whether the right term for our approach to the Soviets was still going to be containment, or whether it should just be deterrence, and that deterrence and the containment people would, you know, have these very angst-ridden back and forths and contests. And so Nick, after the Cold War is over, he's in Moscow at some conference, and he asks I forget who it was, but it was somebody who was very high up in the echelons of Soviet policymaking. And Nick asks this guy, you know, so what did you all make of all those, you know, the debates between the people who wanted to, you know, use the official term of détente versus containment in that moment in the 70s? And the guy looked at him and said, well, we use the terms interchangeably, and we always translated them into the Russian word for strangulation. And I thought that was a refreshing reminder that while we can get so wrapped up in sort of what the bumper sticker is going to be, or how you're going to sort of market and spin these recurring resets, you know, it's important to realize that, you know, the other side isn't always going to, you know, take from these shifts and these terms what you necessarily want. And I thought that was kind of an important reminder of proper perspective.
That's an excellent point to end it with.
Yeah, strangulation. Well, Evgeny, this has been great fun. Let's do it again.
Yes, that's very good.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.